The Israelites are now in the land of Canaan and have made it the land of Israel. When God established Israel, his intention was for there to be 12 autonomous tribes united in their devotion to God, and that God would be their king. How would that play out? Well, we begin to see how that plays out in the book of Judges, which tries to cover the time period from the last days of Joshua until perhaps getting toward Eli and Samuel. It's a difficult time in Israel's history, and the Judges author would like us to believe that it is because they have not served God as they should have. And as we will see, there will be the explanation for all of these things as we now explore the book of Judges. We don't know anything about the author. He probably consistent with Joshua. Maybe it's the same author as Joshua. We have every reason to believe he is an inspired prophetic historian. In Acts 13 and verse 20, Paul speaks of Judges. Hebrews 11 verse 32, the Hebrews author attests to Judges as well. We do not doubt its inspiration. The dating of Judges is some difficulties, because if you look at the other texts involved, we can see that there are about 320 to 340 years that would be for this kind of period, from something like 1400 to maybe 1080 BC or something of that sort. However, there are more years than that when you combine all of the different years of all the judges. We will be harmonizing and reconciling that with the idea that there are probably different judges over different parts of Israel. Even within the Judges text, it seems pretty clear that the judges are not ruling over all Israel, but a few of the tribes of Israel, fulfilling the role that God has given them. And so likely there are many who are serving at the same time in real time. We believe it probably was not written terribly longer after the Judges period. Judges 1:21, we still have the Jebusites in control of Jerusalem. So the audience of the book would be Israel in the period of the kings, and there's a lot we can gain from it. And it's to describe the history of Israel from Joshua to Eli and Samuel, and ultimately to give you a reason to understand why there was a need for a centralized administration in Israel, and the condemnation that comes from serving other gods. We have three main sections, really. We have the early judges in the first five chapters. Then we kind of have the more expanded narratives of Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson in 6 through 16. And then the two appendices with a couple additional stories. So at the very beginning, in Judges 1 and 2, we still talk about the land that's conquered and unconquered. And a lot of this actually is rehearsing or sometimes just repeating some of the things we saw in Joshua. We see that Judah and Simeon fight for land. They conquer Adoni-Bezek and Jerusalem. But then also, Jerusalem will still be a Jebusite city. How that exactly works, we're not exactly sure. We see again that Caleb has conquered Hebron, and Othniel has captured Kiriath Sefer and has taken Caleb's daughter Aksa as wife. The Kenites dwell in Judah, and they also talk about other conquests of Judah and Simeon down in that area. Does not take Jerusalem, will take Bethel. And then there's a listing of all the cities that the Manasseh, Ephraim, Asher, Naphtali did not take. And so at the beginning of chapter 2, there's an angel of Yahweh who delivers a message that since Israel did not take the land as commanded, that there's people who left as a temptation and a snare, and Israel would weep. We're then told about the death and burial of Joshua, how that generation was faithful, and the one afterward, and then that generation passes. The rest of chapter 2 kind of lays out for us what we can call the judges' cycle. That there'll be a generation who arises who does not know God, and they serve other gods. And Yahweh would get angry with them, and he would deliver them into oppression, to an oppressor. And then there would be a guy, or sometimes a girl, who God would raise up to kind of serve as the one who would catalyze victory for the people. They will functionally serve as warlords. They're known as judges. That's what the word is used in the text, is the word for a judge. And it says that they judge Israel. It may well be that people came to them with disputes and things, and they were able to function in a way that we would find consistent with the judge. But we can also understand it simply in terms of somebody who is kind of a temporary leader to consolidate together a sufficient coalition to defeat enemies and to maintain some kind of deliverance and return to the status quo from beforehand. And so after that, though, we were told the next generation would become more corrupt and the cycle would begin anew. And because of this, God will swear to no more dispossess the nations in Israel, that you're not going to see any more conquest than you've already had. And Israel will now just have to dwell in the midst of other people in the land in which they abide, in the land of Israel. And especially in this case, we're going to look at it as Greater Israel, as the land that also expands all the way to the Euphrates and down to the Brook of Egypt. Chapter 3, we meet the first three judges, Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. We see that the Israelites intermarry with the nations, they serve other gods, and then Cushan-Rishathaim of Mesopotamia oppresses them for 8 years, and Othniel, the son-in-law of Caleb, will be their judge and delivers them. We're then told there's an 18-year oppression by Eglon, the king of Moab. And then there's this left-handed man, Ehud, who arises, and he comes in and has a thing for the king in secret. And the thing he's got in for the king in secret is a dagger in his left hand, which they're not expecting because everybody's in a right-hand world here. And the text is very evocative how Ehud's dagger goes into the intestine or something, and dung comes out, and he's just bent over. And his stewards are waiting for an embarrassing long amount of time before they go in and see him dead. And by this point, Ehud has gathered up all of the people around him, the Ephraimites and everyone around him, and they go ahead and they sharply defeat all of the Moabites, and there is deliverance. 10,000 Moabites are in fact killed. Moab is subdued. We're then told quickly about Shamgar and how he killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad and saved Israel. He's very quickly passed over. And then in chapter 4 and 5, we read about Deborah and Barak. Deborah is a judge and a prophetess who was judging Israel. And Jabin, king of Hazor, who is a Canaanite and his 900 iron chariots, have been oppressing Israel. This is one of the first time you see a mention of iron chariots. So we're seeing the introduction of iron, no longer really in the Bronze Age. We're now looking at the Iron Age. Sisera is the commander of Canaanite armies. Deborah summons Barak to fight Canaan, and Barak's only going to go if Deborah goes. And because of it, Deborah says, the glory is going to go to a woman. And 10,000 Israelites are summoned. And we're then also told about Heber and Jael, who are Kenites, who are dwelling near Kadesh. Kenites are a desert tribe, maybe serving Yahweh before the Israelites were, and some evidence of maybe Moses' father-in-law was part of them or associated with them, and they kind of were part of the mixed multitude who came up into the land with the Israelites in this time period of a lot of disruption. So there's this war that goes on between Sisera and Barak. Yahweh does give Barak the victory, and all of Sisera's army is destroyed. Sisera flees to the tent of Heber and Jael that they've had a kind of a treaty agreement with. Jael welcomes him, gives him milk, he rests, and she kills him with a tent peg, hammers a tent peg into his skull. And Barak comes by, and Jael comes and shows him Sisera's body. Israel will continue to press and will completely destroy Yabin of Hazor. And then in chapter 5, we have the Song of Deborah, which is, by common confession, a very ancient document, very ancient song. And it proclaims the victory given by God to Barak and Deborah, and praises Jael and cynically taunts Sisera's family, women waiting for him with all the spoil, even though, of course, the reality is that he has been completely defeated and destroyed. In Judges 6 through 8, we learn about Gideon. There's a 7-year oppression by Midian and the eastern peoples, and it's a very severe oppression. And Israel cries out, and God sends a prophet who denounces Israel's idolatry. And Gideon, the son of Joash, is called to deliver Israel. And the first sign given to him is that there is a miraculous fire that consumes an offering that he's made. God calls Gideon to destroy the altar of Baal and the Asherah, to erect an altar to God. The people seek Gideon's death for doing that, but his father said, let Baal contend with him. And that's how he gets his new name, Jerubbaal, contends with Baal. Midian is in his great encampment, so Gideon summons the tribes of Israel for war. And now there's a second sign God gives to Gideon, that there's dew on the fleece, but not the ground. Then the next day, on the ground, not the fleece. 32,000 men are mustered, which God says is too many. The 22,000 who were afraid are left, and 10,000 are still too many. And so there's a test about how they drink water, leaving only 300. Then the third sign is there's a guy in camp who has a dream. that is understood to show Gideon having victory over the Midianites. And so there's a night attack on the Midianite camp. And they flee. The Ephraimites come out and they slaughter many, including the princes of Midian. Ephraim then contends with Gideon, but Gideon will placate them about the glory that they received. Gideon's pursuing the kings of Midian and is taunted by Succoth and Penuel. Gideon attacks the Midianite kings and the rest of their army. Their army is in panic. The kings are captured. Succoth and Penuel are both punished for their intransigence against Gideon and their unwillingness to support him, and those kings are executed. At this time, people ask for Gideon and his descendants to rule Israel, but he refuses. But Gideon will make an ephod of gold with the Midianite earrings and will lead many astray by it. Now, Gideon has 70 sons, and a son with a concubine named Abimelech. He dies in good old age, and Israel serves other gods. And Abimelech, in chapter 9, will hatch a conspiracy with Shechem, and he will have all but one of Gideon's sons executed. And Abimelech is made king. So he's actually the first king over Israel, if you're looking for that piece of Bible trivia. The last remaining son of Gideon is Jotham. He speaks a parable of the thorn bush, and he invokes a curse on Abimelech and Shechem in 9. And there's this 3-year reign of Abimelech. There's controversy between him and Shechem, because we don't know how far his rule extended. There's a guy named Gaal who speaks insurrection. Abimelech comes to fight at Shechem. Abimelech will capture Shechem and destroy it, will sow it with salt, and burn the tower of it with 1,000 people inside. But then he's going to besiege Thebes, and a millstone was cast down by a woman and it hits Abimelech. He wants his armor bearer to kill him, lest a woman is known to have killed him. Abimelech dies, and thus the curse of Jotham came down on Shechem and Abimelech. In chapter 10, we have an interlude where we talk about some other judges. We learn about Tola and Yair in chapter 10, verses 1 through 5. But then we have Israel sinning, and God delivers them into the hand of the Ammonites now for 18 years, and Israel cries out, but God doesn't want to hear them anymore because of their idolatry. He tells them to get deliverance from the gods they've been serving. Israel puts those gods away, and now Yahweh proves impatient to save Israel, and we have in chapters 11 and 12 the rise of Jephthah. Jephthah is also an illegitimate child, and because of that, he's cast out from the family. And he, in all intents and purposes, becomes a gang leader. People who had some issue or beef or worthless fellows gathered around him and became his posse. The elders of Gilead are so desperate against Ammon that they enlist Jephthah to be their leader. And Jephthah then sends a letter to Ammon and kind of this historical disputation about who has rights to the land of Gilead. Ammon wants to say they do from long before, but Jephthah talks about how for the past few hundred years they've been living there because they defeated Sihon and Og, kings of the Amorites. Then he makes his unfortunate vow that whatever comes to him first from home will become a burnt offering. He does defeat Ammon, and the first thing that greets him is his daughter. And he keeps the vow, she laments her virginity, and he offers her as a sacrifice. The text is pretty clear about that. And that this is now something observed yearly among the Israelites to commemorate Jephthah's daughter. Ephraim, however, is very discontent because Jephthah did not call them. This time, there's a war. It's not placated. There's a war with Gilead, and Jephthah defeats Ephraim. And this is where you have the Shibboleth versus Sibboleth test at the water. The word Shibboleth, apparently there's a little dialectical difference where the Ephraimites would say Sibboleth, this and sh are very similar. In fact, same letter, just a different pointing of the letter in Hebrew. And so anyone who says Sibboleth, they would kill. And so 42,000 Ephraimites are killed. And one of the things that we're supposed to be not impressed by in Judges, but horrified by, is the amount of civil war violence or intra-Israel fighting going on, and how it starts getting successively worse over time. We then hear very quickly about Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon, who judge Israel at the end of chapter 12. And then we get from chapters 13 through 16, Samson. And now the Philistines have shown up. The Philistines, likely the remnant of the sea peoples who have attacked Egypt and may have wrought devastation throughout the ancient Mediterranean world. And they have come and they will oppress in the land of Israel for at least 40 years, if not more. They will only be finally and fully dealt with by David. We then learn there is a man named Manoah and his wife. They are childless, and the angel of Yahweh visits them, and they announce they'll have a son who will be a Nazirite from birth. He's not supposed to cut his hair. He's supposed to stay away from strong drink. Manoah and his wife are probably the most exemplary characters in the book of Judges. There's an offering provided. The angel departs in the offering. They realize it's been a visitation from God. Samson is born, and the spirit of Yahweh stirs in him. And he finds and marries a Timnite, a Philistine. And this is, even though his parents would like him to marry an Israelite girl, but this came from Yahweh as an opportunity against the Philistines. He meets a young lion and kills him, barehanded. The latter finds a beehive in the lion. He takes honey and eats. He has a feast. Samson sets forth the riddle of what has happened. The Philistines threaten his wife. If they lose the bet, she nags at him, and he gives the answer. Samson loses the bet, kills the men of Ashkelon for clothing. He does not take his wife with him, though, and his wife is given to another. Samson wants to see his wife, and he learns he was given to another. And in retaliation, he sets fire to the grain of the Philistines with foxes, with torches tied to their tails. And so the Philistines then kill Samson's ex-wife and her father, and in retaliation, he kills some Philistines and then flees to Judah. The Philistines come to Judah. Men of Judah bind Samson, hand him over. Samson unbinds himself, takes the jaw of a donkey, and kills 1,000 Philistines. Samson's very thirsty at that point. God brings water from the jawbone, and we're told Samson judges Israel for 20 years. Chapter 16 begins. He visits a prostitute in Gaza. There's an ambush set for him, but he simply lifts the city gates as he's leaving town, and he carries them until Hebron. And then we learn about Samson and Delilah, our famous pairing, right? Delilah is his Philistine wife and constantly nags at him to learn of his strength, and he finally capitulates and tells her the source of his strength. His hair is cut, his strength leaves him, he's captured and blinded by the Philistines. The Philistines exult over having defeated their Israelite champion, but his hair grows back. God prays for strength. He prays to God for strength, and then he's able to collapse the house that he's in on himself and the Philistines, and he dies with 3,000 more Philistines, and we're told that's more than he had even killed in his life. Then we have, after these stories, and again, we've gotten to really great times here, haven't we? Two appendices. We'll call them appendices because they're talking about events going on, and there's a compositional unity in them. We don't know exactly where to place them, probably toward the end of the period that has already been described, but we can't exactly fit it into the chronology. So we first learn about this guy named Micah. And he basically says to his mom, hey, that silver that you said was taken, I was the one who took it from you, actually, ha ha. The mother's happy and therefore commissions Micah to make a molten image of Yahweh with the silver. And very clear about this. He makes a shrine and puts up with his household gods. And he makes his son his priest. And this is when the judges author wants you to know there was no king in Israel these days, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. But this time there's a Levite who comes from Bethlehem and he wants a new home. And so he comes by Micah. Micah lives in Ephraim. And Micah invites him in. He gives him room and board and a stipend, and the Levite serves as Micah's priest. And now Micah's convinced, well, hey, I got a Levite as priest now to my statue of Yahweh among my household gods. God is certainly going to bless me now. Now, the other subtext in the story is that the land that the Philistines have conquered and sit in southwest Levant area is the land that was supposed to go, at least in part, to the Danites. And so the Danites are seeking a home because they're not defeating the Philistines. Samson was among them. And look at what happened to him. He couldn't actually defeat them. It's also notable that he's the first judge who's not able to really defeat his enemy. He's able to inflict a lot of losses, but does not defeat them. And so they seek a homeland. So they send out spies. These spies, as they're going through, happen to stop at Micah's house. And they ask the Levite. And the Levite says, Yahweh is going to bless their way. Now, these spies find a town called Laish. And Laish is to the north, and it's a settlement normally of the Sidonians, but it's pretty far away from Sidon. It'd be hard for the Sidonians to protect it. And so the Danites are told about this town, like, hey, this place is ripe for picking. And so they all prepare to make war and journey. And they make it past Micah's house. And the spies say, hey, this guy's got a statue of Yahweh and a priest. You should think about what you should do here. Now, you should realize in Deuteronomy, they're supposed to, you know, take them all out, stone and destroy them. But what instead happens is that they turn aside to Micah's and they get the Levite to go with them. They take the molten image, the ephod, the household gods, and all of it. They take it all with them to go with them, saying, hey, why be the priest of one guy when you're a priest of a whole tribe of Israel? Now, Micah chases after them. He's been wronged, right? Everything's been stolen, right? But when he makes his case against them, all his stuff's been stolen. Then the Danites all look at him and like, yeah, what are you going to do about it? Because, of course, it's a whole tribe and all the mighty men of war from that tribe. And might makes right? Because everyone does what's right in their own eyes. And Micah goes home empty-handed. So none of it's actually benefited Micah in the end. Now, the Danites do capture Laish, and they name it Dan. They'll now be at the town known as Dan. The Levite, Jonathan, and his descendants, priests of Dan, are to the exile. And the Levite Jonathan, we're told, is the son, ultimately, of Moses. And it shows you how far Israel has come. And in fact, his descendants are going to be priests for Dan up there. And the molten image is set up in Dan. And that might be the molten image that remains in Dan for many, many years. Now, we have the second appendix in chapter 19 through 21. And if that was bad, he thought, wait till you hear the next story. There's a Levite of Ephraim who has a concubine who leaves him, and he goes to Bethlehem to get her back. And the girl's father keeps hindering them from leaving, and finally they set out in the middle of the afternoon of the fifth day. Now, they make it by Jerusalem by evening, but they go into Gibeah of Benjamin because they want to stay in an Israelite town, and Jerusalem is still being possessed by the Jebusites. And so they're going to spend the night in Gibeah in Benjamin, the city square. But he's brought in by an old man of Ephraim who sojourns there in Gibeah. Now, the men of Gibeah, they knock on the door. They want to violate the visitor. Very much evocative of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, the man instead sends his concubine out, and they rape her to death. And the Levite is outraged by this, and so he cuts up pieces of the corpse of his concubine and sends them to the 12 tribes of Israel and asks them what they're going to do. So they all gather at his Mizpah, 400,000 men. They hear the story of the Levite, and they need to repay Benjamin for this outrage. But Benjamin isn't going to give up on Gibeah, and so war is on. And 40,000 men of Israel are killed the first 2 days. The war does not go well for them, and they weep before Yahweh. But on the third day, Yahweh gives the Benjaminites into the hand of Israel. There's an ambush of Gibeah. 25,000 Benjaminites die. The cities are destroyed. Only 600 of Benjaminites are left. Now, there's mourning and repentance because they realize, oh boy, we almost exterminated an entire tribe of Israelites. Now, they had all made a vow that they weren't going to give their daughters to the Benjaminites. So Jabesh-Gilead, however, did not come up to fight. And so as a penalty, they destroy the city. They kill everybody but the virgin women. Again, this is an Israelite town. And the 400 virgin women are given to the Benjaminites because to make up for the fact that they made this up their wives. Now we've got 200 left. Now, there's a festival going on in Shiloh soon after this. And they tell these Benjaminites to lie in wait and to kidnap girls that are dancing. And so the girls are dancing. They all get kidnapped. And the guys put up a show of being unhappy with this. And so now they've gotten wives without anyone ever having given them wives. They took the wives instead. And so they have technically not violated their vow. Everybody goes home, and the judge's author concludes the narrative by again reminding you, there is no king in Israel in those days. Everyone does what is right in their own eyes. Well, what do we make of the Book of Judges? Perhaps the most extraordinary thing about the Book of Judges is for the Hebrews author to be able to identify and name people like Barak and Jephthah and Samson as representatives of faith. Because when we look in this book, we tend to see all the moral failings. There are people who do manifest faith in God. In fact, some of them, we think, have some of a misbegotten faith in God, like offering your daughter because you vowed whatever first meets you, you're going to offer, things of that nature. But in general, we're supposed to see this is a very difficult and dark period for Israel. This is a period where God is ruling over them, but they're not really honoring God as their ruler, where the tribes are often oppressed. And if you notice, almost everybody around them oppresses them at some point. All the nations around them are stronger than they. And what it's leading you to, and the author becomes very explicit about this toward the end, is the need for a centralized authority in order to be able to defeat their enemies and to keep them from killing themselves. That when you didn't have that central authority, they spent way too much of their energy and investment killing themselves and not being able to overcome their enemies in battle. And this is a huge problem. And we'll explain why the monarchy developed. And we will have more reason to talk about such things when we consider 1 Samuel. So Judges is a very difficult time period, and we can see how it's not good for man to direct his own steps, and the great sin he falls into when he tries to do so, and the perverse forms of logic that he uses to try to justify and excuse himself. And therefore, we do well to learn from the Book of Judges, to seek after God, to do what is right in his eyes, and to be ruled by him. We're so glad that you've joined us. We hope that you've been benefited by us. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts on Judges, we'd love to hear about them in the comments. Please let us know. Please subscribe to us where you found us, and please share this if you found it beneficial. I'm Ethan. I work with the Venice Church of Christ. We are disciples of Jesus, as a non-denominational church, and we'd love to be of encouragement to you. If there's any way that we can help you out, if you would like to study the Bible with us, you'd like to come meet with us, can we pray for you? Any way we can be of service, please let us know. Reach out to us at VeniceChurchOfChrist.org. You can also find us on social media at Venice Church or Venice Church of Christ. We again thank you, and may the Lord bless and keep until we're able to meet again.